This is the most ticklish point for me in any lecture. I don't have the experience that you girls have with necklaces, and the only purpose of this really is to make a tape. Now, if you'll bear with me. Madam Chairman Nat, thank you very much. And it's a pleasure to begin this, our third study session with the Bible. I wish I could take you into Bible lands physically as well as verbally today. We could use some of its sun and some of its warmth. And I'd like to tell you first a little bit about what I hope to do during these four sessions. I've devoted these four sessions to the basic institutions of biblical life. No society, no history operates in a vacuum. If you want to understand something of modern America, you have to understand our politics. You have to understand our home life. You have to understand something of our religious and secular ideological institutions. And so, similarly to understand the Bible, you have to understand the tribe, the family, marriage, the status of women, the relative status of children. You have to understand something about family life and about community life. You have to understand something about political institutions, and you have to understand something about the religious institutions at which they worshiped. And in a broad way, we're going to cover most of these topics in these 4 weeks. Now, before we begin, may I remind you of one simple fact, probably known to all of you, and that is how we cite a chapter or a verse in the Bible. There are so many different translations of the Bible and so many different editions of the Bible that we don't say we'll open to page 452. We cite the book, the chapter, and the verse. If you've ever wondered why we set as a chore, as a task, for every one of the confirmation classes of the temple to memorize the books of the Bible, it's that unless you really know them by heart, it doesn't do you much good to be told that you're to open to Malachi chapter 6, verse 2, because you don't have the faintest idea where Malachi is, beginning, middle, or end, and it's a big, thick book. So that I will try and give you a place in your Bibles. I can't give you a page. You have many different Bible editions. But about where this book that I refer to is, and if you want to set yourself a task between this week and next that will facilitate this and any other Bible study you ever undertake, memorize the books of the Bible. It's not that hard. Now, let's begin with the tribes. Moses, according to our Torah, brought the Jews out of Egypt to Mount Sinai, and then after some 40 years of wilderness trek, he brought them to the east bank of the Jordan River opposite Jericho. Jericho is about 5 miles north of the point where the Jordan River flows into the Dead Sea. And then the Bible tells us Moses died, and the mantle of leadership passed to Joshua. A quick reading of the sixth book of the Bible, the book of Joshua, would seem to indicate that this worthy led the United Confederation of the Hebrew tribes in a quick and easy conquest of a major portion of Canaan. This is Canaan. Here's the Dead Sea, here's the Sea of Galilee, the Mediterranean, Transjordan. As you'll see, the settlement is not only in the, what we call today Israel, and that part of the Kingdom of Jordan, which is west of the Jordan River, but includes all of Transjordan, this large body of land, almost equal in size to Israel. Now, the problem is, if we push it out, it's others can't say, but let's try the best we can. Now, the picture that's given in the Bible is of a bloody and successful battle. And if you'll turn to Joshua chapter 10, which is the sixth book of the Bible, and you look at the verse 40 in chapter 10, and read with me. This is a summation of the wars of Joshua. So Joshua smote all the land, the hill country, that's that spine of mountains that runs north to south, towards eastward towards the Jordan River, and the south. The Hebrew word is Negev, and it means exactly that part of the land which we call the Negev today. And the lowland, the Shephelah, which is the part that Tel Aviv and Jaffa running up to Haifa, the coastal plain, and the slopes, and all their kings. He left none remaining, but he utterly destroyed all that breathed, as the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded. And Joshua smote them from Kadesh Barnea, which is here, unto Gaza, which is here, and all the country of Goshen, which is down towards Egypt, even unto Gibeon, which is in here. And all these kings and their lands did Joshua take at one time, because the Lord, the God of Israel, fought for Israel. And Joshua returned, and all Israel with him, unto the camp to Gilgal. And then if you'll read one more sentence with me, the last sentence of the next chapter, chapter 11. So Joshua took the whole land, according to all that the Lord spoke unto Moses. And Joshua gave it for an inheritance unto Israel, according to their divisions by their tribes. And the land had rest from war. Now you have seen in history books of the Bible this kind of map, which shows you a division of the land into the various tribal parts. Manasseh, here and here, Naphtali, Asher, Zebulun, Issachar, Gad, Ephraim, Dan, Benjamin, Reuben, Judah, and Simeon. This is the traditionally assumed division of the land among the tribes, and the portions we have just read would lead us to assume that Joshua established the tribes in possession of this territory, that the conquest was swift and easy and complete. But like so many other war stories, the picture is false in most of its parts. Joshua 11, which we've just read, prates, so Joshua took the whole land, and the land had rest from war. The conquest is complete. Presumably, the victory is total. But the very first sentence of the next book of the Bible, the book of Judges, begins, and it came to pass after the death of Joshua that the children of Israel asked of the Lord, who shall go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? So it's obvious that the Canaanites, who were in possession of this entire land, had not been defeated by Joshua, and that they retained the possession of almost their entire country, if not their entire country. And from the rest of the book of Judges, it is clear that Israel, at the death of Joshua, controlled few, if any, of the major cities of Palestine, none of the coast or the valley of Jezreel, and only a part of the central highlands. Old warriors, I'm afraid, not only never die, but they tell terrible stories in their retirement. Essentially then, at the time of Joshua, a very small part of Canaan, just in the hill country here, is controlled by the tribes under Joshua, not this entire structure. Now, I want to begin the seminar by speaking of the Hebrew tribes at the time of the settlement in Canaan. We're now roughly in the 13th or the 12th, or the late 11th centuries before the Christian era. This is the early Iron Age. This is about the same time as the Assyrians begin to become dominant in the land of the two rivers, which is now today Iran and Iraq. And when the great empire builders of the 19th Egyptian dynasty, Ramses and Akhenaten and Thutmose and Seti II, were building the great pyramids and temples of Egypt. These opening chapters are sufficient to indicate that as far as Palestine was concerned, this is a confusing and unclear period of Jewish history. But it's historically all important, for out of the political and religious events of the period of Joshua and the Judges grew the Israel which produced the prophets and the law and our scripture. Institutions and ideas were forged in this period, which lasted throughout biblical days and affected every aspect of biblical life. So much for the preamble. Now, the organizational unit of Israel at this time was the tribe rather than the nation. A tribe is, by definition, a mobile, closely knit association of clans and families which have a sense of blood relationship. They are governed by councils of elders or councils of clan chiefs, and they assume responsibility for the act of each of the members of the tribe. Now, traditionally, as we have seen, there were 12 tribes of Israel. The Bible speaks of the 12 tribes again and again and again. This and something of the organization of a tribe is clearly seen in the census, which Moses is presumed to have taken the second year out in the desert. If you'll turn to the first chapter of the book of Numbers, which is the fourth of the books of our Bible, you'll see this very clear description of tribal organization. And this, by the way, precedes the entry into Canaan. Numbers chapter 1. And the Lord spoke unto Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting, which was a central point of assembly, on the first day of the second month, in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, Take ye the sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel, by their families and by their fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male by their poles. Now, their families is a word you know, mishpacha. And it means technically a clan. It's a group of cousins or brothers who are heads of families themselves, who are bound and closely knit together. And groups of clans represent a tribe. The word father's house is Beit Av. It's the word in the Bible which describes again and again the family. Now, the family is not the nuclear family which we're familiar with, a father, a mother, then the children. And perhaps a grandmother. The family was the father or the grandfather, the oldest male in the family line, his wife and wives and or wives, his sons and their wives and their children, his unmarried daughters, and any other collateral relatives that happen to need his protection. So we're talking now of a family in terms of perhaps 50 people or 80 people, not in terms of 5 people or of 6. And only the males, as you can see, are counted. In Judaism, a minyan is a male-oriented phenomenon. And you're to count these males from 20 years old and upward, all that are able to go forth to war in Israel. Ye shall number them by their hosts, even thou and Aaron. And with you there shall be a man of every tribe, every one head of his father's house. In other words, there shall be one chieftain, and the sheik or chieftain is part of a council of elders that will control the organization of the tribe. And these are the names of the men that shall stand with you. Well, the names are unimportant, but here again we get the list. Reuben, Simeon, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, who's divided into two parts, Ephraim and Manasseh, Benjamin, Dan, Asher, Gad, Naphtali. These were the elect of the congregation, the princes of the tribes of their fathers. They were the heads of the thousands of Israel. And the Bible, I'll just put an aside here, the numbers are always exaggerated. And the word thousands is a technical word borrowed from the Babylonian environment, which means simply a company of troops. If you take one or two zeros off most biblical statistics of population, you can approximate the numbers that they're dealing with. If you've ever seen a biblical town, the greatest of the towns, Megiddo or Haran or Beit She'an or Beit El, The entire occupied area of the town, inside the walls, might be no bigger than this room. And the Bible will speak of the town as having been one of the great cities in Israel, and you sometimes hear of thousands of men going out from the, issuing out from the town to battle. And Moses and Aaron took these men that are pointed out by name, and they assembled all the congregation together on the first day of the second month, and they declared their pedigrees after their families, by their fathers' houses, according to the number of names from 20 years old and upward by their polls. Now this word pedigree or genealogy is an important one in the Bible. The Bible begins with genealogies, and the book of Chronicles is an entire genealogy, and genealogies are constantly developed in the Bible. In the ancient Near East, your relationships determined your citizenship. Your relationships determined the law by which you were born, under which you were governed. If you're an Israelite, and you could prove your blood relation to the Israelites, you were governed by Israelite law. Your pedigree was all important. And though we Jews today make a great deal of laughing up our sleeves at those, the English and others, who make a great deal of genealogies, let it be said that in earliest times, we were great believers in genealogy for very practical reasons. It established a man's status and established a man's citizenship. And the Bible is filled with genealogies, always, by the way, done in the male line. And this is where you get somebody that's been somebody. That's the way Hebrew generations are always reckoned. And so the Lord commanded Moses, so did he number them in the wilderness of Sinai. Now here we have, obviously, the picture of a convocation or conference of the 12 tribes. Obviously, the tribes aren't assembled together. Each sends a representative to Washington, except here it's the tent of meeting. And they enact the laws of the tribe and make the decisions along with Moses. There never was in ancient Israel a supreme authoritarian figure. Within the tribe, the sheikhs of each clan met with the supreme chief of the clan. Within the nation, in the confederation, the chiefs of each of the 12 met with Moses, and they met with Joshua, and they met with the judges. And interestingly, even under the kings, they continued to meet. And when the kings got out of line, it was almost always the confederation of the tribes, which is called technically Kol Yisrael, all Israel, in which rebellion began. They were summoned into being, the king tried to impose his law, the sheikhs wouldn't have it, and then you got the kind of political tension which leads to battle. To return to the number 12 and to the idea of the 12 tribes, the numbers here are quite specific. They are 12. Reuben, Simeon, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, the two sons of Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh, Benjamin, Dan, Asher, Gad, and Naphtali. And the number 12 is emphasized again in the story in the first part of Joshua, where God commands Joshua just before he crosses the Jordan, take 12 men out of the people, out of every tribe a man, and command you them, saying, take you hence out of the midst of the Jordan 12 stones made ready, and carry them over with you, and lay them down in the lodging place where you shall lodge this night. Now many of you have been to the Near East and to Israel, and you've seen those heaps of stones by which the people demark the ends of their property. Apparently we have here a symbolic rite before the conquest where they took 12 stones and they built a marker which indicated their control of the entire land, none of which they yet controlled. In other words, they were throwing over all the other boundary markers and establishing their own. But the importance for us here is the emphasis on the 12. 12 stones, 12 tribes, 12 appointed delegates from each tribe. Now the tribes are not named, only numbered in this part. But turn with me to the fifth of the books of the Bible, the book of Deuteronomy, to chapter 33. This is almost the last section in the Torah and the five books of Moses. And this section purports to be the blessing by Moses of the tribes of Israel just before his death. The census, you remember, is the second year in the desert. This is some 38 years later. Now run your finger with me through the text and look at the names. There's Reuben, and there's Judah, and there's Levi, and there's Jacob, and there's Benjamin, And there's Joseph, there's Zebulun, Issachar, Gad, Dan, Naphtali, and Asher. Interestingly, there are only 11, not 12. Now, traditional commentaries got 12 by reading the longish section on Joseph, which begins on verse 13, and not listing Joseph as a tribe, but listing the two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. That gives you 12. But this isn't the point I'm trying to make. If you compare this list with the list in Numbers 1, you find that this list has in it the tribe Levi, and the list in Numbers 1 does not. And the list in Numbers 1 has in it the tribe Simeon, and this list does not. In other words, they substitute Levi for Simeon. What I'm trying to say is that the list of the tribes was never certain. Each tribe had an individual history. Some may have come into being long before the Exodus and disappeared even before Joshua came into the land of Canaan. We have, for instance, an interesting section, a very early section in the Bible, in the book of Judges. I don't turn to it, but let me simply tell you about it. There's a great woman warrior, the Joan of Arc of the Bible, Deborah. One of the Amorite kings, a princeling of a little city-state by the name of Sisera, attacks Deborah's tribe, and Deborah summons all of Israel to the defense. She summons the 12 tribes, but she includes in the summons, tribes are called Caleb, Machir, the Kenites, tribes we've never heard of in these original lists. 12 tribes she summons, but only 8 of them are familiar to us from the list in Numbers 1, and only 9 of them are familiar to us from the list in Deuteronomy. What I'm trying to say is this, that 12 was an artificial number. 12 was a number which obviously had deep spiritual meaning to the tribes, but there were never 12 tribes, and then there was never this kind of arrangement between the tribes of Israel. The tribe of Levi, for instance, you've heard of the Levites, those people who were the servants in the temple. The Levi is the second man in the traditional synagogue who's called up to the Torah to recite the blessing, first a Kohen, then a Levite, then an ordinary Israelite. The tribe of Levite began in its early history as a political tribe like any other. Now, we don't know what happened to it. It was obviously destroyed. And somebody survived out of that tribe, and that somebody built up a clan which began to serve as professional ministrants at the cult centers. And the Levites became not a tribe, but a clan of professional priests in time. This tribe, Simeon, was one of the first to settle in the land. We think there are some references to it in Egyptian texts. But by the time the Jews under Joshua come in the land, Simeon is no more. It's disappeared. Caleb, Machir, southern tribes both. We know no more of them than that they existed, that they were part of the Israeli Confederation, and then they are no more. So what we have to do, if we could do it, and we can't, to create a real history of the tribes of Israel would be to trace the history of each of the individual tribes. We know, for instance, the tribe of Manasseh came into the land, and then for some reason was pushed out of this area, which is now Israel, and came back across the Jordan and settled in Transjordan. We know that the Benjaminites, whom you see down here, were originally settled way up here in what is today Syria, were pushed out of the land and came down into this area. Now, we don't have sufficient historical data to reconstruct this history in its entirety. All we can say is that the number 12 was religiously significant and was arbitrarily kept up by the tribes. Whence the number 12? No one knows. It probably comes from the 12 months, the 12 signs of the zodiac, and an early cultic responsibility in Israel which said that every tribe must serve at the tent of meeting 1 month of the year. Here was a way of providing service for a cult which in its early form had no priests and had no Levites, had no professionals. 1 month a year, you were responsible, your tribe was responsible for the ark and for the tent of meeting. In later times, this became what was known in the Bible as the Ma'amadot. The Ma'amadot are the convocation in Jerusalem of representatives of the 12 tribes, one each month. And at the same time, back home, the tribe met and prayers were read, the same prayers that were recited while the sacrifices were going on in the temple. And one of the theories about the origin of the synagogue is that the synagogue grew by these tribes meeting back home without sacrifices, without priests, simply praying with the prayers that were being recited at the temple at the same time. And this would explain, for instance, why the traditional services are still called by the names of the sacrificial services: Shachrit, Mincha, Musaf, Maariv. These were all the names of the traditional services in the temple. We know of other uses of the 12. The high priest in the temple wore a breastplate. It's a large gold or silver, we can't know now, ornament with 12 different colored stones, like the birthstones, one representing each of the 12 tribes. And a great deal of divination was done based on how the light rays shone onto these tribes and what blend of colors came off and so on. And there was also in the temple a great, what was called a yam. It's a tremendous basalt basin, which was to represent the primordial sea on which the earth rested. It was also the place where all the libation offerings were brought. And this yam, we know from the biblical description, was held up by 12 Assyrian lions. Again, this number 12. But beyond that, we can't pierce the secret of the 12, except to say that it was all important in the original organization of the tribes. Now, one other sort of historical aside before I begin to delve into the structure of the tribes. You've all seen the Chagall windows. I noticed that reproductions of the Maharana, a buckboard display over there. They're now in the Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem. They represent the 12 tribes. Have you ever wondered where the symbols of the tribes come from? And I hope beyond the Chagall windows, you've noticed our windows, the fine Jip windows in our chapel. Again, they have in each window the symbol of one of the 12 tribes. And if your eyes are keen, I hope you've also noticed that on the frieze of the balcony of the temple, there are woodcuts representing the symbols of each of the 12 tribes. Now, were these their totems? Were these their shields? Were these the family coat of arms? Not at all. If you turn with me to Genesis, to the last chapter of Genesis, it's Genesis 49, you'll find a chapter which purports to be the blessing by Father Jacob of his sons. And his sons were traditionally the progenitors of the tribes. Now, this is not a blessing. The chapter, first of all, curses some of the sons, as no father would. On top of it, this chapter is simply a collection of poetry, popular poetry which describes the tribes. The way we'd say the British are reserved and the French are amorous and the Germans are stolid. This is the kind of generic description that some poet felt called upon to make of the tribes. And his imagery was translated into symbol and became the symbol of 12 tribes. Now, for instance, look at verse 21. All right, let me show you. Yep. Naphtali is a hind let loose. He giveth goodly words. Right. In this series of little Persian plates from our temple museum, we have a rather symbolic painting or drawing reproduced on the silver of a hind on a mountaintop. And this becomes Naphtali, and the Hebrew is the Hebrew of the text I've just read to you. And Naphtali is always the graceful doe or the graceful ram, either jumping or prancing or dancing on the hilltops. Now Joseph, in the very next verse, Joseph is a fruitful vine, by a fountain. You see the willow, the vine, the branches on it. And if you ever want, by the way, I'll give you another bit of art history and biblical history here. The Hebrew phrase is Ben Parat Yosef. fruitful vine is Joseph. And at least that's the way it was translated for 3,000 years. And this plate, which was done 75 years ago, and most of the symbols which show Joseph are done this way. This phrase became a great symbol of fertility. And when women could not have children, the amulets which they were given by the tzaddik in the Hasidic villages or by the religious teacher in an Algerian village used to have this phrase, Ben Parat Yosef, written up and down the acrostics this way and that on it. But about 40 years ago, with the development of modern science, we discovered that Ben Parat Yosef couldn't possibly mean a fruitful vine is Joseph. It was a word which had appeared only once in the Bible, and this was a guess from 2,000 years ago. But there were some Akkadian words which represent parat, the same root, as a, what's called an onager. Now an onager, I've looked it up, an onager is simply a wild goat. And so most modern representations, if they follow the revised standard versions of the Bible, present Joseph as several wild goats with the horns flaring, you know, it's very attractive. And interestingly, our Zik windows in the chapel show Joseph in this way. The temple frieze, which was done 45 years ago, still has Joseph as the vine. The one in the chapel done 15 years ago has Joseph as an onager. I didn't look at Chagall's windows, but I would suspect he's still, if he has Joseph, Joseph is the vine, the more traditional one. But if you want to know if a man likes biblical criticism or doesn't, look at the symbolism of his art. Now, I said that not all of these descriptions were laudatory. Take a look at verse 16. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan, Don, means judgment. Go on. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path that biteth the horse's heels, so that his rider falleth backward. Dan was obviously a tribe which controlled one of the great crossroads of the caravan trade routes. And they were either pirate brigands or they levied excessive tolls, and they were hated by everybody else for doing it. And you have a reflection of this history in this particular verse. And so Dan becomes not the judge in his black robes, but the coiled serpent about to bite somebody in the heel. There's some other interesting bits of history. I always wondered when I was younger. No, I want Issachar here. Why Issachar was a heavy, fattish, ugly, uncouth-looking beast. I can never make out quite what he is. In the windows in the chapel, he looks like an overfed camel. In the frieze of the temple, he looks like a swayback horse. Here, he's simply sort of an overfed jaguar or something of that kind. He's a plodding, sedentary, rather ungainly type. Why? If you look at verse